for any claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. Many of you will be thrilled, ecstatic, that you're not hearing, you know, Tom Lehrer again, although I think that has a very serious message. I've been a huge Beatles fan forever. I had a show where I'd play Beatles at the opening, at the break, at the end, I mean, all the time. And so I have responded to the call for help. How much more appropriate could it be than help from the Beatles? Now, I do have a special guest today. I think you're going to find quite fascinating, but I want to begin with a few developments in the news and talk about the False Flag and Conspiracies Conference that will be conducted Saturday and Sunday, tomorrow and the day following, with a 24 presentations. I mean, it's just chock full of information, knowledge, experts, students of false flag and conspiracies. But I begin with another trial having the right result, to wit, Jussie Smollett found guilty of lying to police in hate crime hoax. Now, this is interesting on many counts. Of course, the whole thing was just ridiculously obvious. Jussie, you know, coming out of a subway at 2 a.m. on the coldest night of Chicago and supposedly confronted by two white supremacists wearing ski masks and I think even a mega hat, declaring this is mega country. They had a bottle of bleach and a noose and they, you know, allegedly poured it on Jussie, but at the temperature, the bottle of bleach, which is primarily water, would have been frozen solid. Who's wandering around the street at 2 a.m. wearing a mask, waiting for a black gay actor to walk out of a subway? I mean, it was absurd on his face. And it turned out that those he had recruited were two black Nigerian brothers, bodybuilders, one of whom is Jussie Smollett's personal trainer, the other an extra on the set of Empire, where he was an actor, since he's been given the boot, deservedly so. But the whole event, he paid for it with a personal check for $3,500. They have CCTV in the hardware store where the brothers are buying the stuff that they would use. They even testified that Jussie had set the whole thing up. And yet Jussie was acting as though it was all bona fide, and he pulled some ridiculous stunts, which I think are going to work against him because he showed no contrition, no admission. Rolf Lundgren, who I expect will join us on Monday with an update on politics, believes that because Jussie, you know, defied reality by continuing with his masquerade, he might get 6 months in jail as a consequence instead of some kind of probation. Meanwhile, here's the way the story is being told. Actor Jussie Smollett was found guilty Thursday on 5 of 6 felony counts of disorderly conduct for making false reports to Chicago police that he was the victim of a hate crime in January of 2019, an attack prosecutors said he staged. You can mute. You can mute, and I'll bring you in at the right time. The jury of 6 men and 6 women, whom I understand were 11 whites and 1 black, deliberated for 9 hours over Wednesday and Thursday before arriving at their verdict. Dressed in a suit and tie, Smollett appeared rigid after the verdict was read. I guess he was disappointed his stunt hadn't worked where he was performing on the stage. He did not move, was seen gazing straight ahead. I mean, the disorderly conduct for a false crime report is a class 4 felony, punishable by up to 3 years in prison and a $25,000 fine, where the Cook County judge, James Lynn, will have discretion in imposing a concurrent or consecutive sentence for each count at a later date. I believe that Rolf is right, and he's actually going to serve time for the absurd way in which he handled this. The judge said of the jury, Mr. Smollett would not have lost his case as he did today unless a jury found that he lied to them. The fact that he came up with a completely ridiculous story to explain his misconduct did not apparently have an impact on the jury's verdict. That was actually not the judge, but the special prosecutor, Dan Webb, who carried the case against Smollett. Webb said he couldn't predict whether a follow-up perjury charge would be filed for his testimony on the stand, which, of course, was under oath. But those who are convicted of crimes are not normally charged with perjury as well, even though they have lied to defend themselves. There's so much that was going on here that was so absurd on its face, where even the newspapers today are not even pointing out that those who attacked Jussie were both black, that one was his personal trainer, another an extra. They're not even mentioning that, much less that Michelle Obama's chief of staff intervened with Kim Fox, who was the original Cook County prosecutor assigned to the case, who dismissed the charges under political influence, tried to steer it to the FBI. We understand why, since the FBI has been completely politicized. Let me remind you how in Las Vegas, for example, those who were oblivious of the fact the whole thing was a staged fake event and turned over their cell phones and their laptops for the video records, only to have the FBI erase them, you know, not keep them, take them into custody as evidence, but to erase them. That's indicative of what was going on here, what Kim Fox, I think, would have liked to have the FBI involved so they could essentially erase the whole case. The brothers testified Smollett orchestrated the attack. Smollett, who's black and gay, told authorities he was the victim of a racist and homophobic attack near Chicago apartment early that morning. After the story broke, many celebrities, politicians, and advocacy groups rallied behind the 39-year-old actor, who, according to police, said the alleged attackers at 2 a.m. as he walked back from a Subway sandwich shop. By the way, his sandwich survived the event. Chicago police investigated as a possible hate crime, but soon concluded he'd orchestrated the incident. They said he paid two brothers he knew from the TV show Empire to stage the incident for publicity. Smollett said he paid the brothers for training advice and nutritional tips. I mean, the guy's lies are just unparalleled. Now, this all appears to have been done at the request or for the benefit of Kamala Harris, who had a bill before the Senate, an anti-lynching bill co-sponsored with Cory Booker that no one seemed to think was necessary. So the event was staged so she could talk about and describe this as a modern day lynching to justify the bill. In other words, everything about this is phony and fake, including Kamala Harris, who, as we know, has the worst poll ratings of any vice president in American history. The brothers, Obla and Ola Osundario, were among seven witnesses for the prosecution. They testify Smollett directed them and paid them to stage the attack. They say in an attempt to get media attention, they should have connected the dots to benefit Kamala Harris, whom I understand to be his aunt. And we have photographs of Jussie out on the stump campaigning with Kamala. They fake punched him, poured bleach on him, which I'm suggesting they couldn't actually have done, put a noose around his neck, used racist and homophobic slur because he told them to. Who was in charge of this thing, Webb asked? Jussie was, Bola told the jury. I mean, it's just, you know, embarrassingly bad. Also, told jurors Smollett had the crazy idea of having two MAGA supporters attack him so he could put it on social media, not understanding, apparently, that this was all done to benefit his aunt. Defense attorneys also called seven witnesses to testify, highlighted by Smollett himself. Over 8 hours Monday and Tuesday, he lauded his version, attempted to cast doubt on the brother's true motivation, and explained his distrust for police. "Have you ever planned a hoax?" one of his attorneys asked. "Never in my life." I mean, how embarrassingly bad? How embarrassingly bad is this? Now, in many ways, this is highly beneficial. We've had this series of jury cases that I think have been very damaging to the Democrat agenda and platform. Defund the police, critical race theory, the whole world's divided into the oppressors and the oppressed, and the oppressors are the whites and the oppressed are everyone else. We had Kyle Rittenhouse appropriately acquitted on the basis of self-defense for the events in Kenosha, where he shot three men, killing two who were actually attempting to kill him, one with a skateboard, the other with his bare hands. And I mentioned in passing, more people die in the United States by being murdered with their bare hands, by being beaten to death or strangled, than die from being shot to death, where the overwhelming majority of those who are shot with handguns, not with rifles, which are very rarely used. Where I was just unbelievably impressed with Kyle's facility to use that weapon. As a former Marine Corps officer who used to train recruits with 15 DIs and 300 recruits under my command, I mean, including marksmanship training, I mean, Kyle, very sophisticated. Then, of course, we had the event in Waukesha, where you had this black BLM supporter apparently pissed off about the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict, mowing down a bunch of whites in a parade in Waukesha, Christmas parade. How horrendous is that? And now he's claiming he's being dehumanized or demonized in the press. Well, I can't imagine what action anyone could take that would be more deserving of demonization. And then we had the Aubrey trial down in Georgia, where three whites were convicted of killing a black. Well, according to the Democrat narrative, that's not supposed to happen, that white men just get away with murder routinely. And now you have here a black actor, actually, if I understand correctly, a relative of the vice president, being convicted for an unbelievable stunt that was ridiculous beyond belief, where this was, obviously a sanctioned hoax. It had a lot of powerful players behind it, but it was absurd on its face. I don't know how they thought they could get away with it. In any case, all this appears to me to very powerfully undermine the Democrat narrative. And by the way, we now find that, a lot of those communities where they were defunding the police have found cries rising dramatically, as though that were a surprise, unexpected, or not predictable. And therefore, they're having to refund the police. But the damage has been done. I mean, it's incredibly stupid that they ever adopted that. James Carville, for example, a very shrewd Democrat political strategist, said he thought it was the dumbest slogan that any campaign had ever adopted. And you've even had prominent Democrats denying that that was their position. But of course it was their position. And we had Maxine Waters and, Nancy Pelosi, AOC and others cheering on the arson, the rioting, the looting that took place all last summer. I mean, it was just grotesque. There was no law enforcement, none of the appropriate. It was all supposed to be part of social justice, just as presumably they're going to justify all the smash and grabs that are going on in California now, where they're looting on an organized scale, bringing up caravans of automobiles. So everyone hauls out $950 worth of loot because the DAs, Soros supported out there, have all declared they're not going to prosecute for less than $950. So you get an endless number of people each stealing $950 worth of loot. I mean, look how fast that adds up. This is stupid, and it's a matter of deliberate Democrat policy that they're implementing this. where gun sales have just shot through the roof, because everyone recognizes if you're going to defund the police, by God, you're not going to be able to defend yourself. And where they've seen, I mean, with their own eyes, the looting, the riots, the arson taking place, they know they better be able to protect themselves because they cannot count on the police. Now, on my blog, I published a wonderful piece by William DeBerg entitled "You'll Owe Nothing and You'll Be Happy" about the Great Reset, where the World Economic Forum, representing the Western global elites, are promoting this idea that this is the agenda as Klaus Schwab has spelled it out. Everyone is going to have their credit cards, their mortgages, or student loans paid off in return for surrendering all their property and assets and agreeing to a regimen of vaccination where it appears that they want to make everything digital so they can control our lives completely and utterly. Anyone wants to see a nice illustration on a microcosm, check out the wonderful film Enemy of the State with Gene Hackman and Will Smith. Just a brilliant, brilliant film. If you've never seen it, you really must. Now, among the points that DeBerg makes, the idea of them taking control of all assets is not as much of a stretch as it might seem to dispossess the near whole of humanity, given the top 1% already control 99% of its wealth. So I think that's a great point. He talks about the amount of housing now controlled by investors and especially private equity firms is growing rapidly. While older age groups are more likely to own their own homes, they are under siege as well, with a prospect of runaway inflation caused by massive printing of fiat currency, alarming and seemingly inexplicable supply chain collapses, and even stranger worker shortages. Let me say, the supply chain collapse is a deliberate policy of the Biden administration. We had a deputy secretary of the Treasury come out and say, the supply chain problems won't be fixed until every American is vaxxed. Every American is vaxxed. Well, think about it. What does vaccination have to do with supply? Nothing, nothing in the ordinary causal chain of events. This is because of outside intervention. Truly disgusting. Along with the COVID lockdowns, the supply chain collapses, worker shortages, and other inflationary pressures, an albatross has been thrown disproportionately around the neck of small businesses. In fact, David Icke was among the very first to say all these lockdowns and the COVID was to bring about the greatest transfer of wealth in world history and to wipe out the middle class. And I believe that's exactly right. It appears that the preferred future is one of the type envisioned by the film Hunger Games. I mean, if you want to get a sense of the future, I suggest you take a look. It's pretty grim, where basically they have the objective of reducing the world's population from a present nearly 8 billion to only 500 million. Think about it. That's a reduction of 7.5 billion. And I dare say, I believe before all this is over, they're going to have succeeded by depopulating Earth by at least a billion. And I say that on the optimistic assumption that the courts are starting to oppose the mandates, that it's getting harder and harder to get people to take a shot that is going to damage them seriously, if not kill them, where the numbers are simply staggering. For example, and this is now over a month old information, the World Health Organization had a database of adverse effects that numbered over 2 million adverse effects. Neurological, physiological, gastronomical, you know, your cardiovascular system, your kidneys, your liver, even neurological and psychiatric problems that are induced by these mRNA vaccines, which of course are only called vaccines, as it were, as a courtesy by the CDC, which appears to be completely dominated by the Rothschild banking empire. Here we have a final piece of the disposition puzzle is the impending switch from eroded fiat-based currencies to new digital ones, where the name digital currency is highly misleading since almost all financial transactions are already perform with direct deposits and withdrawals, electronically created Federal Reserve funds, cyber transfers, credit cards, and other digital means. But what it really means is they want to get rid of cash so that you don't have the freedom of buying things without the government or those who are monitoring your electronic transactions knowledge. So they want to have complete knowledge of everything we do. I mean, this is just unbelievably god-awful to control us. So DeBerg observes, if none of the above trends are reversed, the same elites gobbling up businesses and farmlands and houses and cryptocurrencies will get richer while the peon class gets poorer. But if you're a member of the latter, no need to worry. The World Economic Forum guarantees you'll be positively giddy in your poverty while watching the Bezoses, Musk, Zuckerbergs, Gates, and a whole bunch of other trillionaire wannabes crying out in their beer over all their massive wealth and power. Now, it just so happens that the head of the World Economic Forum, Klaus Schwab, is, surprise, surprise, a Rothschild. Henry Mackow has now published a piece, Jacob Rothschild, Equality is the Endgame, where he makes observation like these. In your efforts to protect your old and failing civilization we are dismantling, we find these means necessary. If people will allow such vaccines to invade their own bodies and their children's in order to comply and be the same or equal to everyone else, they most certainly will not object to or oppose their wealth, use of resources, and lifestyles being equalized as well. Everyone must do the same. In all communist nations we have fostered, it's customary that for equality, for the desired and planned leveling in this new order, for people to have the same in their needs and wants, everyone has to be psychologically trained to obey the same commands. The universal vaccine programs not only open the door for behavior control through gene modification and enhancement, but more importantly for the present operation, psychological behavior control with vaccines is even more fundamental. Regardless of whether or not the vaccines are unnecessary and useless regarding the virus or even harmful to many, they are the most uniform and concerted psychological weapon ever devised to control human behavior. This is Henry Mackow talking about it, where Rothschild is confirming that the COVID is a hoax, but claiming it's necessary to re-engineer humanity to address the problems we're alleged to face. There's more to it. And I would say among the presentations that are going to occur at the conference this weekend, there is one where Henry and I will be discussing this in some detail. Let me give you an inkling as to what's going on here, where you can visit my blog at jamesfetzer.org for more. The Volkswagen Conspiracies 2020 conference. I have 24 speakers. So I got a dozen Saturday presentations, a dozen Saturday, a dozen Sunday. A number of speakers are giving more than one. Nick Holerstrom, for example, who's just absolute one of the best in the world talking about the gunpowder plot as one of the early false flags in the UK. Holly Seeliger about Bacon's Rebellion, a false flag at Jamestown, one of the first in the USA. Next generation students. Was Pearl Harbor really a surprise attack? I'm going to review what happened to JFK, drawing upon the collaborative research I've been doing since 1992 with the best experts to ever study the case, followed by a special report on 9/11, where as the founder of Scholars for 9/11 Truth back in December of 2005, I brought together experts from around the world, engineers of all kinds, including aeronautical, mechanical, civil, structural, pilots, physicists, to figure out what actually happened on 9/11. So this will be a distillation of the discoveries we've made. Then the next generation students again turned to COVID-19, conspiracy or act of nature. Kelly Watt, who's just a terrific person with a lot of initiative, exposes fake news about a pandemic right in her own community. David Kinney, attorney, California COVID, swindling the public. Dina Sachs, another expert legal on the vaccine wars, a legal perspective. Susan Bradford on the politics of business. Abramoff and Enron. Sarah Westall herself, an investigative journalist, the COVID conspiracy and mind control. Sunday, starting off with Nick again, who wrote Shakespeare's plays, Alison Maynard, The Undead, Three Young Women, Interesting Cases. Then I'll talk about A Tale of Two Cities, Kenosha and Waukesha, followed by Russ Winter and others, taking a close critical inspection of those events, High Strangeness, the Waukesha Psy-Op. Then Ron Avery, who's followed my case, I knows a tremendous amount about the law, the Posner versus Fetzer lawsuit. Then another, he himself has been involved in fake news and fake law in a police state. Joe Olson, the engineer to whom I alluded, the fall of America, Carl Herman, American Revolution 2.0, Scott Bennett, former Army Intel and PSYOPs officer on the coming war in Ukraine, Henry Macau, Jacob Rothschild, equality is the end game. Then Jack Mullen and Stephanie Sledge, where are we heading? Followed by Ole Domegaard, how my last name became a verb. Check it out. Go to False Flags and Conspiracies at jamesfetzer.org, or you can go to Mix and Stream, M-I-X, capital N, Stream, and you'll get more information. So check it out. Remember, 1% control the world, 4% are their puppets, 90% are asleep, 5% know and try to wake the 90%, where the 1% use a 4% to prevent the 5% from waking up the 90%. And when we return from the break, I'll introduce my guest, who has much to tell us about events like these and other frauds perpetrated by the American government. So stand by. We'll be right back. Break pending. Join you then, and we'll put out the number for calls to come during the last segment of the show today. Here we have it coming on. Check it out. False Flags and Conspiracies 2021. JamesFetzer.org or Mix and Stream. Both ways can get you access to tickets.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? and that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, my guest today, Phil Kresge, joins us from Spain. He's an author, very intelligent guy who does a mix of history and fiction. So he has, for example, work on the raid on the compound in Pakistan, where, as I have reported already, Osama bin Laden actually died on 15 December 2001, buried in an unmarked grave in Afghanistan. In accordance with Muslim traditions, there were local obituaries, both CNN and Fox News on 26 December 2001 reported that Osama bin Laden was dead. And yet a decade later, Barack Obama staged this phony raid on the compound in Pakistan in order to claim that he got the most wanted man in the world and position himself for a triumphal reelection. Well, Phil's been exploring these in this mix of truth and fiction, and I'm very glad to have him here. Welcome to The Raw Deal, Phil.
Hello, Jim. It's really good to talk to you again.
Yes, I'm delighted. Go forward. Tell us about your latest publications and research.
Well, let's see. My latest book is part novella, which is about 100 pages. Takes people about 2 hours to read. And that deals with the controversy of American prisoners of war who were abandoned in Vietnam after the war and after the peace and after the prisoner exchange and everything like that. They remained in Vietnam. And the other part of the book, the other half, is 6 short stories. You mentioned one of them, which is called The Rainmaker, which is Well, it's sort of a satire, to be honest with you. Maybe you remember, Jim, that just before the raid on bin Laden's supposed house there in Pakistan, apparently the CIA went to Obama just a day or two before and said, look, we do not know if he's there. We haven't been able to spot him. And so I wrote a story about a CIA man in a big meeting of all the, you know, different CIA chiefs and the DIA and all the sort of far-flung galaxy of American foreign, American intelligence. and a CIA guy trying to explain to everybody, look, we think he's not there. That is, he's not there. We can't find him. We've been looking at this house for 6 months. He is not there. And all these people in this meeting say, no, 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 this is impossible. You've got to make him there. And Obama's man is in the meeting and says, no, no, my president is looking at re-election. It's going to be difficult. You've got to make him there, and we've got to take him out. And so finally, this guy called the Rainmaker, who's an old hand in PSYOP sort of operations, he intervenes, and he starts to build a story by which they can say that Osama bin Laden was there. And some of the people who have interviewed me and reviewed the book, they've made the point that they find my discussion of how the Rainmaker ensures that this version is going to be accepted, they find that very interesting. And one of the things they find most interesting is when the Rainmaker says, look, we don't have to really prove our whole case. All we have to do is give a plausible case. As long as we do that, people will accept it. And he says, you always have to remember that in these types of cases, whether it's 9/11 or JFK or Osama bin Laden, the government always plays with the home court advantage. And as long as they give a plausible explanation for what happened, people will accept it. And that's everything that the naysayers throw at it is going to be very hard to, it will be very hard to be accepted by the citizens, as long as the story itself is basically plausible. And that's what they build. They build a plausible story, which ends with the actual what happened in the raid, what we are told happened in the raid, that is. And so at the end of the story, it's the only picture in the book. I have a picture, the one that was published by the Defense Department, of Osama bin Laden on a video, the video taken of him and him sitting on the floor with a remote control in his right hand, not his left. He's left-handed. He was left-handed, watching Osama bin Laden, or watching Barack Obama on his television. And it's just making the point that this is how the whole thing was created, how the whole illusion was created. So anyways, that's one of the stories. The other stories are less political, more personal, or funny, or satiric. There's one about some guys in a bar in Minnesota, because that's where I'm from, as you are, Jim. These guys are sitting in a bar and they complain about how boring soccer is. So they start to make up ideas to make soccer more interesting, and making the goal bigger, and putting maybe only three people on the field and things like that. So anyways, there's a little of everything in the book.
Well, Phil, it seems to me you're talking about Henry Kissinger's observation that the facts don't matter. All that matters is perception, particularly when you control the media, so that in Alex Jones' phrase, which was incredibly perceptive, we're engaged in information warfare, and where, you know, the social media giants have been performing massive censorship, in my opinion, at the behest of the state. And while they claim to be exempt from, for example, the First Amendment as independent companies, actually, if I'm correct, that they're doing this at the behest of the state, they are eligible for lawsuits, where six of my books have been banned by Amazon. And I intend to move forward, provided I have the financial resources to do it, against Amazon. It's just outrageous what's happened, because these private companies have been violating what it means to be an American and have the right of freedom of speech, freedom of the press, and the rest. Twitter, Facebook, Facebook locked me out of my account years and years ago. Twitter, that was about a year ago, just overnight banished my account. I had like 2,500 followers and 2,500 tweets, and one day it was there and the next day it was gone. YouTube has removed hundreds of my videos, and I'm not alone. I mean, this is happening massively to anyone whose point of view doesn't correspond to that which is the official narrative. So, Phil, tell me more about your take on freedom of speech, freedom of the press. I think that, you know, your type of historical fiction managed to make its way to get your points across without running the risk of being censored. Would I be right?
Yeah, I guess that's a good point, Jim. I've never really thought of it that way. You know, the story about the American POWs left over in Vietnam, which I'll go into that a little bit more in a minute, just so that everybody's on the same page. But the story about the prisoners left over in Vietnam was written up in a long article by Sidney Shanberg, who had won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the Vietnam War. And just before the 2008 election, he, between McCain and Obama, he wrote a long article talking about how McCain had collaborated with the Vietnamese when he was a prisoner of war, making sort of Tokyo Rose style recordings to be played over to the other prisoners. And also at the end of his article, he talked about all the most important evidence that prisoners of war had indeed been had remained behind. Well, he wrote this very good article. Nobody would publish it. Not the Times, not the Post, not the Journal, not none of the major news magazines. And it ended up being published on a small website. I think it was the National Interest or something like that. But anyways, he couldn't get it published anywhere, which just goes to show you, you know, how the media works, you know, in America and even where I live here in Spain. It's a very similar story here.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, we're right. John McCain was never on my list of favorites. I mean, he was actually involved in creating ISIS, which was done by Hillary Clinton, John Brennan, and Barack Obama in 2012, where ISIS was known as John McCain's army, where he even met with al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, to terrorize the Syrian people, to rape, loot, murder. I mean, it's unbelievable what our government has done with the approval of our Secretary of State, Director of the CIA, and then President of the United States, where Michael Flynn, who was then the Director of National Intelligence Agency, objected to doing this so that Brennan suggested to Obama he ought to fire Flynn for opposing their bizarre plan to create this god-awful entity that would rape and loot and terrorize, which Obama obligingly did. And of course, all your stuff on Osama is highly appropriate, because he was actually an official, an officer in the CIA, Colonel Tim Osman, an official of the agency, visited him in a hospital in Dubai shortly before his death from his medical maladies, as I've already described. And of course, he was also instrumental, and this is omitted from Charlie Wilson's war, in getting Stinger missiles into the hands of the Mujahideen, which they used to shoot down Soviet helicopters and planes to drive them out of Afghanistan. So he's really quite a fascinating character and has been grossly misportrayed by the mainstream and the administration to promote its own political agenda.
Ironies of life, absolutely. Let me just give a short history of the problems of the American POWs, just so that everybody understands what was going on. What happened was that the war ended in 1973, okay, after 11 years. And in 1972, Henry Kissinger, who had already been a couple of years negotiating with the North Vietnamese to end the war, he finally was desperate to get an agreement, because that's the, you know, that was the campaign promise of Nixon, that he would end the war in the campaign of 68. So he finally, Kissinger finally had to accept one of the key Vietnamese demands, which was that the United States would pay war reparations to North Vietnam after the war. All right, so they established a separate committee, a committee separate from the negotiating committee, to determine just how much America had to pay. And at the end of, you know, hair pulling and all that, they came up with that the United States would pay $3.25 billion down, and then between $1 and $1.5 billion after that, depending on different circumstances. And the Vietnamese accepted this. Now, what happened was the United States didn't, and Vietnam didn't put that, the numbers in the treaty. The treaty only said that the United States would pay war reparations. The numbers were all spelled out in a letter, a secret letter, actually. Nixon and Kissinger loved secrecy. A secret letter from President Nixon to the president of North Vietnam, Pham Van Dong, and spelled out all the money that the United States would pay, okay, in a private letter. All right, and the Vietnamese accepted this and said, okay, we have a deal. All right, the war ended and in 73, and the Vietnamese sent back only 600 men. And in Washington, across Washington, the gasp was audible because they had expected well more than 1,000 men. But anyways, very quietly, the North Vietnamese let Washington know that when you pay the war reparations, guys, we'll set free the rest of the men. They had done the same thing with the French, you see, in the French Indochina War, which ended in 53. And the French actually were paying big money to get their men back until the early 70s, if you can believe that. And anyways, Hanoi told Washington that you have to pay this money, and Washington never paid. And the whole cover-up began, that Washington said, no, all the men have returned, there are none left. And Hanoi said the same thing, but in quiet, you know, in the back room, this debate was going on. And finally, in about, what was it, about 1976, 77, there was a meeting between the Vietnamese and the Americans, and the Vietnamese pulled out the letter from Nixon and said, come on, guys, what about this? This is black on white here. Washington said, the men in the meeting said, we do not consider that letter binding, but we want our men back. And so the whole thing never got off the ground. Hanoi insisted on money, Washington insisted on their men, and that's where it ended. And so in about 1979, you know, there were all kinds of, you know, rumors and things, you know, in the big massive exodus from Vietnam when the North invaded the South and very quickly won. A lot of people arriving in America, Vietnamese, said that they had seen Americans working out in the field and, you know, in chains and terrible conditions, so on and so forth. Washington denied everything. And in 1979, one man escaped. He was a Marine private, and he managed to slip a message to a guy from Finland, actually, who worked for the World Bank. Guy got back to London, got the message published in The Guardian and on the BBC, and then the word was out. Here was an actual American who was still a prisoner and who wanted out. Big headache for Washington. So when this poor guy got back to the United States, he was immediately arrested, court-martialed, and called a traitor and a collaborator, because, of course, they wanted to discredit him. And the poor fellow, his name was Robert Garwood, was eventually drummed out into the street on a dishonorable discharge. He was convicted only of the lesser charges at the end. And because, of course, in Washington, they wanted to discredit him because he might have seen other prisoners, and indeed he had. He estimates that in the time after the war, he saw a total of about 200 men. So anyways, this is sort of the basis of my story. My story is about nine prisoners of war in the year 2010. Okay, these are men in their late 60s, early 70s. They managed to escape from Vietnam by ship. And they get as far as Spain. And the ship captain is getting, you know, by now the Vietnamese, the Americans, somebody has detected that, you know, where these guys are. And all of the different ship captains in the area are getting messages. We want to search the ship. You, when you're going through the Straits of Gibraltar, you have to stop, and we will, the Americans want to come aboard to search the ship. So the captain gets cold feet. He puts the men down in a life raft and calls the Spanish Coast Guard. Now, of course, normally the people who are crossing the straits in little boats are people crossing from Morocco, trying to reach Europe, trying to reach Spain, and to you know, to seek a new life. So the Spanish Coast Guard, you know, hauls them in, as they haul in people almost every day, and the men insist on talking to somebody from the American embassy. So the central figure of the story, Paul Clippin, is an American diplomat in Madrid at the embassy, takes the high-speed train, goes down to the South Coast, and talks to these men and realizes who they are. And that's sort of where his adventure starts. His immediate response is, okay, I'll take you guys up the coast to the American base, turn you over to them, and they'll repatriate you to the United States. And the men say, wait a minute, we're not sure how they're going to receive us, because, of course, the Pentagon, the White House, the State Department, everybody has always denied that these men still existed in Vietnam. And they said, look, we would really prefer you in the State Department to sort of scout the terrain and you know, see what's the best way to get us back to the States. So that basically is the story of Clippin talking to reporters. First, his idea is to try the same as this guy did back in the 70s, get something published in a newspaper and sort of present the government with a fait accompli. And so he talks to some reporters. That doesn't go so well, and he has to do some other things. And that's what the story is about. And it's a very sort of poignant story about a very poignant issue, something that I've always thought, I've followed for many years, and I've always thought was a very sad sort of coda to the Vietnam War.
Well, the immorality of the American government to enter into negotiations and then to default is something we have a history of doing, including the solemn negotiations between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev over the dissolution of the Soviet Union, where we agreed that we would make no encroachment upon the Eastern Bloc nations that were to become sovereign states, nor any effort to militarize them, when we have done precisely the opposite. In fact, there's even an effort to take Ukraine, which historically has been a part of Russia. Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his book, The Grand Chessboard, even talks about Ukraine as the breadbasket of Russia, because it's an agricultural center for the Russian population, just as California is an agricultural center for the American people. And that if you could pry Ukraine away from Russia, you'd greatly weaken the bear. And there are efforts and talk to you know, even make Ukraine a member of NATO, though it turns out now that in a brand new report, Biden has declared that Ukraine won't be eligible for NATO for years to come, which I suspect was a message he got from Vladimir Putin that would be a very unwise thing to do. Although I harbor the suspicion that the Democrats are in such dire straits politically, they want a war, because historically wars unify the population in support of the administration. But I don't think in this case, given the low quality of this administration and its utter incompetence demonstrated in every possible way, canceling the XL pipeline, for example, making America energy dependent on foreign sources again, the fiasco of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, leaving the open borders in the South, inflation rising, I don't think this administration has any credibility whatsoever. And if a war does break out, I think most of the population will see right through it as an effort to regain political stature that they have lost, in my opinion, irretrievably. Phil, we're having this memorial service for Bob Dole, and he, like John McCain, were both figures for whom I had no particular regard. I probably had a stronger negative opinion about McCain than I did about Bob Dole. But he never struck me really as a very serious or significant figure on the American political stage. Your thoughts, briefly, before we hit the break, and then we'll return to further after we return. Yours?
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that about Bob Dole, I don't have a lot to say. I always thought he was a very negative sort of figure, and that perception of Dole, I notice, is being very stoutly put down in the mainstream media. They present him as a guy who was very willing to compromise with the Democratic side and look at all the legislation that he got passed with Democrats and so on and so forth. You know, Jim, one of the real joys of living in Spain is that you're not subject to these media frenzies like the death of Dole or the death of McCain, things like that. And you can see the whole thing with a little bit more, objectivity. But,
well, Phil, I'd like to return to that after the break. We'll be right back with my special guest after this break.
Okay.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting "This is a drill, this is a drill" on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out "And Nobody Died in Boston Either." Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope.
tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job? That Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had muted inadvertently. Yeah, my guest, Phil Kresge from Spain, has a perspective on America that I think we could benefit from hearing. Phil, I'm very interested in your take on what's been going on in America with a Trump administration in relation to world events, then the Biden now coming in January 6th, any and all of the above. Your thoughts?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that what I see from Europe is that Europe is slowly drawing away from the United States, more or less in shock from what they're seeing. I mean, one thing, of course, was the storming of the Capitol building, but more to the point, it's the bombastic style of Donald Trump and before that, George Bush, who enjoyed no respect at all in Europe. Barack Obama, for all his faults, did a lot to restore sort of the good name of America in Europe, which Trump, you know, sort of destroyed. And people just couldn't believe, and I think still cannot believe, that America, you know, could elect a man, you know, who, you know, apart from his ideas, which people can agree or not with, just the style of his administration, the style of, you know, his personal style, people were found very abrasive and offensive. And I guess that in general, what I see from Europe is just the ever smaller common ground that American politics now occupies. There just is so much basic disagreement about what's going on. And there, you know, the whether you agree or not with AOC and people like that, what's obvious is that their ideas cannot penetrate into the Democratic Party. And of course, a lot of people agree with those ideas. What happens in Europe in this case, for example, here in Spain, is that new political parties are born. And in the last 10 years, three important political parties, one leftist, one more centered, one more extreme right, have been born. And this is very healthy because it absorbs this political energy and it gives a voice to the ideas of this part of the political spectrum. Because the two main parties here, which are very much like the Republican and Democrat parties, they have been seen as corrupt and inefficient. And that's why, these other parties have grown up. But in America, you just don't have that, because it's almost impossible for a political party to make any dent in the political system, because it's very hard to get on the vote, to get, to get on a national, to be on the national ballot, et cetera, et cetera. And from what I've heard, since Trump, the Democrats have made it even more difficult for other parties to get involved. And that's why I believe, Jim, there is so much political pressure building up in America, because these other political points of view don't have a political outlet. They don't have a voice. And, it's great for the two major parties to, run the show this way. But I think that they just do not realize that they're digging their own grave, because this is going to explode sometime. And I think slowly it is exploding.
Well, I certainly have a far more charitable view of Donald Trump than you're presenting here. I mean, he executed a hostile takeover of the Republican Party, turned it from a rich man's country club party into a populist party. He actually moved the interests of the American people front and center, the whole idea of America first, not squandering our resources on foreign entanglements. He's the only president of recent times who did not get us into a new war. While I don't approve of everything he did, in particular by moving the American embassy to Jerusalem, declaring the Golan Heights to be a part of Israel, unfunding the UN organization assisting Palestinian refugees, and even redefining anti-Semitism to include complaints about the actions and policies of the government of Israel, he revived the economy. The lowest earning wage earners were seeing their wages rise at the highest rate. He had clamped down on the border problem. It was all but solved until Biden-Harris decided that anything Trump had done was bad and they had to reverse it, which had been catastrophic. I think he was actually very good for America. My history politically have been to vote Democrat by and large, regarding them as the better candidates. I voted for Bill Clinton twice. I even voted for Barack Obama twice. But I believe they both did enormous damage to America with NAFTA, for example, under Clinton. When Ross Perot talked about that giant sucking sound of all the jobs moving south, he was absolutely right. And Obama, among his many other adverse effects upon America, was to nullify the Smith-Mudd Act of 1948, which precluded the use of the same techniques of propaganda and disinformation within the United States that were being used abroad, including staged riot, paid events, and all that, by the Smith Modernization Act of 2012, just in time to bring a Sandy Hook, which has been followed by a whole host of staged fake events, where I brought together groups of efforts to dissect what actually happened. I mean, serious scholars. In the case of Sandy Hook, 13 experts, including 6 PhD professors, where we established a school had been closed by 2008, that there were no students or teachers there, and that it was a two-day FEMA exercise, technically a mass casualty drill involving children, that was presented as mass murder to promote gun control. That was a Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Eric Holder, Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy, Connecticut State Police, Newtown School Board event to, you know, instill fear into the hearts and minds of every parent in America. It was outrageous. It was a terrorist act, a faux one indeed, but most people regard it as real. I can never forgive him for that. And there's a whole host of other issues where I would, you know, rate Barack Obama well below Donald Trump. And when it came to the choice between Hillary Clinton, who has a history of corruption almost unparalleled in American history, and this guy who was a fresh breeze, in my opinion, it was a no-brainer to support Trump. So you'd have a hard time convincing me that there was a big problem with his style. He spoke down to earth. He related to American people. You should see video from in the 2020 campaign when he was coming in on a helicopter in the hills of Pennsylvania, and there were tens of thousands of people out waiting his arrival. I mean, it was truly moving just to observe, something I do not expect you saw from Spain, but also where, you know, I detect a bit of detachment from what's actually been going on here in the United States, because I think that many, many Americans continue to support Trump. He actually won, if you had a legitimate election, an overwhelming re-election. Sidney Powell showed an electoral map where Trump was, the country was red from coast to coast. He carried California and Minnesota, which I'd been predicting, 410 electoral votes. The whole thing was a sham. Now, are you telling me, Phil, that from a European perspective, the election of 2020 was on the up and up, or that the alleged insurrection on the 6th of January was a bona fide event, and it wasn't, in fact, 226 Antifa members dressed as Trump supporters, led by John Sullivan, as his brother James has explained, that it wasn't, you know, orchestrated by FBI provocateurs and the like, because there's overwhelming evidence on both counts. I'm just terribly interested in the difference in perception, because I'm living through this. I'm reporting on these matters every single day. Every single day I'm reporting on these matters. And it seems to me what you're offering is really a rather a jaded point of view here about what's actually been going on in the USA. In fact, Rasmus and poll in December of 2019 showed that 40% of black likely voters were voting for Trump, which I think just sent a shiver down the spines of every Democrat political figure in the US. And they knew they had to do something desperate. Under the guise of the COVID, they relied on mail-in voting and an assortment of fraudulent methods to steal the election, unprecedented in American history. And we've had plenty of elections that were corrupt. I turn the floor back to you, Phil.
Well, let's see, Jim. First of all, what I was referring to was more Trump's style, which rankled with, you know, European leaders and the European public here. A national leader, and especially the American national leader, is supposed to be a much more sort of staid and stable figure with, you know, a very nice avuncular style. And of course, that is not Donald Trump. So what I'm talking about here in Europe is more Trump's style than his substance. I give Trump some high marks. For example, in moving towards the resolution of the Afghanistan conflict, which of course it was Biden who finished up, but it was Trump who took the real brave step in actually moving to end the war. So anyways, I'm talking more about his style in Europe that rankled with a lot of people. As to, you know, the thing like whether or not the election was stolen, and I agree with you, I think it probably was, and other things like that. When I talk to people here in Spain about that, and I say, well, you know, there's a little bit of doubt about who really won, people here are really shocked because they don't hear that side of it at all. News coverage here is very much like CNN or any of the mainstream media. You never get into the backstory of things, in regards to another country. And even people who are politically aware here in Spain, and I've talked to them about those things, they're pretty shocked to hear it. The perception of America and things like that is very much controlled by the major media, which is very similar to what you see in the States. It's not even with COVID, here in Spain, the rate of vaccination is over 80% now, and one of the reasons is that there hasn't really been any serious discussion about whether or not it's not good for you. There just isn't any of it. You can find a few small websites that talk about it, but by and large, people listen to the government. Well, we have to do this, and so people do it. And so the backstory of politics that you get into, and of course very usefully and very crucially, really does not resonate so much here in Spain. I'm hesitant to talk about the rest of Europe. I think in France and in Germany, they are more politically aware and those things are more talked about, but I really can't talk about that.
Well, sure, I appreciate that. Well, what is your take based upon your own assessment of what's going on here with a great reset and all that? I would be glad to hear your point of view. And to me, it's tragic such a high percentage of Spaniards have been inoculated, because everything I can tell is it's going to have serious damaging effects on the vast majority of those who receive the jab. Luc Montagnier, the world's leading virologist, has even reportedly said everyone who gets a jab will be dead within 5 years. Sherry Tenpenny has described it as a perfectly designed killing machine. It's not actually a vaccine. The virus has never been isolated, so you couldn't possibly have a bona fide vaccine for it, but it's a form of gene therapy that introduces very bad elements into human beings and other living things. I'm convinced that they did all the animal experiments and all the animals died. They simply didn't report it because that was the outcome they wanted, so they moved forward. In the past, a medical procedure or product that had a tiny, tiny fraction of the adverse effects we're getting now would have been pulled off the market immediately. And the fact it's continuing forward, even when the World Health Organization has a data bank of over 2 million adverse effects, I mean, it's just absolutely stunning what's taking place here and required most powerful resource and behind the scene to make all this come out, which I attribute to the Rothschilds, and where the evidence is becoming increasingly familiar, where, as I observe, Henry McAu is now publishing a piece, a letter he believes written by Rothschild himself, which is declaring that this is what we're doing, taking over the world. They want everyone uniform, but of course they make an exception for themselves. Bill Gates, the Rothschilds, the Mucky Mucks aren't going to give away their money to be uniform with everyone else. No, it's going to be masters and slaves. It's just outrageous what's taking place as I see it. Your thoughts?
Well, first of all, one of the things that troubles me about the COVID vaccination thing and how dangerous it is why so many governments are so enthusiastic about it. I mean, I look, for example, at the Israelis. Now, the Israelis apparently have all had three shots now. The Palestinians have had practically none. And if the scientists are correct, well, in 5 years, the Palestinians are going to be able to walk into Jerusalem, take over without firing a shot, because there won't be any Israelis to oppose them. And so the whole thing of why governments are pushing this when they know it's dangerous is something that sort of puzzles me. Maybe you have some thoughts about that.
Well, I think that's a good observation. I have heard there's a deeply embedded apocalyptic vision that a third of Israelis have to die before they can have the second coming of their God, and that the Mashiach, and I mean, I'm not an expert in this area, but there are those who believe this is a part of it. What's going on in Israel is very bizarre in many ways, because they have reportedly such a high percentage of those who are vaccinated. And if they're actually getting the mRNA vaccines, then indeed the outcome you describe is what we have to anticipate in the future. So it's a fascinating situation.
The Palestinians are going to have the last laugh, it seems.
I think that would be wonderful. But the fact is that, you know, the vaccines are so horrific that it's an utter dereliction of duty that they're being promoted. And, of course, fortunately, the courts now in the U.S. are taking stands against the mandates as unconstitutional, exceeding the president's authority, which was obvious from the beginning. But as I've often observed, the problem occurs between the time when an unconstitutional practice is implemented and the time it's actually brought to before the courts, which can take years before they're declared to be unconstitutional and brought to a halt, because there's a whole lot of damage that can take place in the meanwhile that's been taking place right here in the USA and elsewhere, of course, around the world, where our courts will not inhibit those actions abroad. But I don't think Spain's going to come out of this in very good shape. I'm very disturbed. But, of course, it's like many other European nations. They have bought into it whole hog.
Yeah. And so many governments have. The other thing you mentioned, Jim, that you asked me to comment on was the Great Reset. Just so I'm on the same page with you, can you just briefly summarize that? Jim, are you there? Jim, yes, hello. I'm not hearing anything.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I'm talking about the Great Reset coming, you know, promoted by the World Economic Forum, which was founded by and headed by Klaus Schwab, who is himself a Rothschild, which entails paying off your mortgage, your credit card bills, your student loans in return for your surrendering all your property and assets, in return for which you're given a guaranteed stipend and a place to live. It'll be a cubicle. And as long as you adhere and behave, then you'll be allowed to survive. Otherwise, you're going to be sent to a COVID camp or a reinternment or re-education camp. It's a horrific future. Efforts to implement, which appear to be going most forcefully forward in Australia, where the people have been disarmed. See, I think that's why America is the special case. We have had the benefit of the Second Amendment. And an unarmed people is unable to preserve their freedom. I think the Second Amendment is every bit as indispensable as our first, and it's those two that define America most distinctively. Your thoughts?
Oh, I see. I see what you mean. Well, it's certainly, you know, a horrific future to think about. And it reminds me a little bit of British ecologist James Lovelock, who talked about how he was one of the first scientists back in the 70s to raise the alarm about global warming and CO2. And his prediction, he wrote a series of books called The Theory of Gaia. And Gaia is Greek for Earth. And in which he talks about how the earth is reacting against what man is doing. And his prediction was that at the end of this century, humanity would consist of about a half billion people living up around the Arctic Circle, because the rest will have died off through heat and through malnutrition, because, agriculture and everything will become impossible in the second part of this century. And so, you know, when you talk about the Great Reset, who knows, maybe these people have seen the writing on the wall, because the writing is on the wall, and maybe they consider that this is the best way to keep enough munchkins around for them to serve them, you know, and to make their coffee and clean their houses. So it doesn't surprise me that this is a going debate, especially among the super rich and the people in power. But I really wonder, with this COVID crisis, how many people they think that they're going to save to serve them. I mean, just look, for example, at nuclear power plants. If you don't have people to run them, well, look what happens. You have a Fukushima. And if you have, 450 Fukushimas around the world, well, this is going to be a pretty awful place.
Well, I've got to take exception to the whole global warming agenda. It turns out that CO2 actually is indispensable to life. Of course, it's converted by trees and bushes into air, oxygen we need to breathe, but it also has the effect of cooling the earth in four different ways. So the whole thing seems to me to be pseudoscience and a gigantic scam. The idea of going to electric cars and green energy is just, in my opinion, completely ridiculous. And if you destroy the gas and oil economy of the United States, it will descend into third world status, which I believe the proponents thereof have as their desired outcome. Let me just mention before we hit the break that we welcome your calls, 540-352-4452, 540-352-4452 for Phil and me. We'll be glad to hear from you about any of the issues we've been addressing, where in some cases we agree and others fairly strongly disagree. But we're very glad to get your opinion. And of course, I believe very strongly in freedom of speech, diversity of opinion, and the importance of debate to reach the truth. We'll be right back.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Revolution Radio every Wednesday 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job? That Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, let me mention that my guest, Phil Kresge's book is entitled A Legacy of Chains. I think it has much to recommend it. We have a first caller on the line from the 281 area code. Caller, please give us your first name and your state and join the conversation.
It's Bruce in Texas.
Hey, Bruce.
Hello. Yeah, good guest. I appreciate him being frank about the opinions of the European public has been shaped by the media. You can look at coverage by the BBC and see how that's done. It's totally opinion formation, perception management. Trump was rough around the edges. It's Americans like that. I remember they used to really pillory Ronald Reagan when he was in office. They swooned over Obama. Obama and they would have preferred Hillary. Hillary's the one that's responsible for putting us in this position. Her and Barack Obama on the verge of World War III because they conducted the Ukrainian coup. So I don't see how they can, hate Trump. Trump did more for peace than any president in recent history.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with you, but Phil may have a different opinion. Go ahead, Phil, your thoughts.
I think that I generally agree with the caller, because Trump indeed didn't start a war, and he at least, kept America out of other conflicts that I'm sure a lot of the sort of war party and Pentagon people were probably urging him to get into. I think especially, for example, in Venezuela, they wanted to do something very serious there. But I think that with the Ukraine, that whole thing is, I think, very much outside the purview of the White House. I think that that is mainly the people who are very much in charge of foreign policy who are not necessarily in power or wear a uniform. They're the people who make sure that such and such happens in American foreign policy. One of the things that I think is very significant, for example, is that Biden has not changed Trump's position on Cuba. Biden's former boss is the one who opened up. Trump closed the door again, and Biden has done nothing to change that. And so I think that the whole push to get American influence greater in the Ukraine and to bring it into NATO and so on. I think that those are things that are outside the president, that are a part of a much more general plan that the White House, whoever the president is, must accept.
Bruce. Yeah, I agree. The international financiers who actually control politics, the bankers, what have you, the Rothschilds, et cetera, we like to say, they're ultimately in control of Western politics. And also on Osama bin Laden, I watched the coverage of the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which was 2 days before the raid. I believe it was April 30th or April 29th. And it just seemed to me that it just struck me at the time that Andrea Mitchell was there, et cetera. And they were all gushing and all like they had a secret. You know, they're giddy. I'm sure that they were let in on a secret that this was going to happen, because several days later, the news broke in the United States at Central Time at about 9 p.m. And there's all the big heads, the big figures of each network were there in the studio reporting on this raid. You know, like what was Andrea Mitchell doing in the studio at you know, 10 p.m. Eastern Time? You know, and she was ready for it, you know, so this was leaked to the press. And let's not forget the Reuters or Associated Press put out a fake death photo of Osama bin Laden that was actually Iraqi, that was photoshopped. And there's just so many things that, and then you had Extortion 17, the helicopter that was shot down with all the SEALs on board. Yeah, the whole thing is hokey. I agree totally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the bin Laden raid was total nonsense. And I was very happy the way the story called The Rainmaker turned out. And a lot of people who read that were very, got a good chuckle out of it and said, yeah, that's very much what might have happened behind the scenes. Yeah.
Well, is there is there a European or Spanish perspective on these matters? Of course, there's diversity of opinion in every nation, but is there a general impression that it was bona fide and on the up and up, and that Osama actually had been killed in this raid on the compound in Pakistan in 2011?
Oh, yes, absolutely, Jim. Absolutely. The media here very much follows whatever the Washington CNN line is on anything like that. There is no question of it. Maybe in a few small blogs and websites here in Spain, people say, hey, wait a minute, there are a couple of strange things here. But by and large, it is accepted without any question. It's really very sad to see, but the kind of questioning that we're doing here on this show is very rare here. It's a pity.
That's extremely interesting. I want to bring in my producer, Mitchell, who's very active in politics in Virginia, for his perspective. Mitchell, join the conversation.
Hey, hello, Jim. Hi, Philip. Hello, Bruce. I wanted to... what I really wanted to add was that it appears that, you know, this the placebo effect, you know, where, you know, one third or generally so of people will turn something that is completely false and a fiction into something that is real. And then I just keep seeing this pattern where this, I guess it would be a political psyop before, but now it's an actual planned demic psyop, and that people are effectively making this real, even though it's a fiction. Do you see that in Europe at all?
In terms of what you might call domestic politics, there's a lot more questioning, and there's a lot more questioning of motives, and reporters who dig beneath the surface and look at financial shenanigans and power shenanigans. You know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, that kind of thing. But in terms of those major questions like COVID, there's very little of that that goes on. It's very disappointing to see.
Well, that's very interesting. Bruce, further thoughts from you?
Yeah, sure. One more before I have to hang up. During the coverage of the Osama bin Laden, quote unquote, raid, outside the White House, there was a spontaneous demonstration by university students that were shouting, USA, USA. I believe they were from George Washington University, if that's the closest one to the White House. And they were waving American flags that were freshly creased, but they were just taken out of the box that night. So that tells me that that was all positive. Maloney.
Mitchell.
Well, you know, just as Biden tried to coax the Afghani president, we live in a world of, you know, of perception and not reality. And so they believe that they can create reality through perception any way you slice it today. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I quite agree with Mitchell. And the thing that I think is interesting is that nobody teaches the reporters to do this. I think that they learn to do this just by watching what other reporters are doing and looking at what their network or their newspaper wants. And then they simply make their decision. If I want to get ahead in this profession, this is the line I have to toe, and that's the end of it.
Bruce, I take it is no longer available, unless Bruce, you want to squeeze in one more. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Yeah, to me, the lowest point in Western European politics in the last 20 years was the attack on Libya through NATO and through the United States. That was just, I didn't see one demonstration or even one crossword about it. This is just a disaster. It was terrible. And I don't understand why there was no popular opinion formed against it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I quite agree with you, Bruce. I thought it was a disgraceful thing to do. And it was very much against European interest, because Gaddafi used to keep the immigrants south of Libya and not allow them to cross the Mediterranean in small boats. And but I think that especially France and England wanted to do this to show how tough they were. And the Americans also were happy to do it, because Gaddafi was always something of a revolutionary. He was always sort of pebble in the international shoe. And when there was a little bit of protest against him in the Arab Spring at that time, they took advantage of it and said that everybody was against him. And that really was not so much the case. But they saw a chance to get rid of Gaddafi, and they did. And I think it was disgraceful. Libya had the highest standard of living in Africa with Gaddafi. Everybody had a house and a car and education right through university, you know, men and women, and healthcare and everything. And it was really a pity what happened to that country. Ask Libyans if they have any of that nowadays. It's pretty sad.
Oh, there's even been a restoration of slavery in Libya. The Moriartis who were there then, I've interviewed them twice. I mean, it was a wholesale slaughter of Libya, which may have been the most humane society ever created on the face of Earth. Gaddafi was putting the oil resources of the nation for the benefit of the Libyan people. And of course, the French didn't like his development of the Great Waterworks Project, which would have turned North Africa into a veritable oasis. The Rothschilds were unhappy with the idea of introducing a gold dinar, which would have rapidly become the currency of all of Africa. When the alleged rebel group in Libya, as its first act, founded a new central bank, I knew that things were not as we were being told. And as you observe, yes, everyone had a home, an automobile, they had a public health system, national education, newly married couples got a $25,000 gift from the government. It was really what Gaddafi was doing was simply the most humane and responsible and nurturing government, I think, ever on face of earth. It's just astounding. And yet he got slaughtered viciously, and Hillary played a key role in all of that, needless to add.
Yeah, in Europe, there was not much reaction against what had happened. For one reason, for example, here in Spain, Libya was never a very visible sort of country. Just Gaddafi with his posse of female bodyguards. And I think that people here really didn't know much about it at all. And so when he was thrown out, well, it was just the end of a dictator, and people didn't think any more about it. And that's how the media played it here. It was pretty sad.
That is pathetic. I mean, even Aristotle observed that a benevolent dictator is the most efficient form of government because he can bring about the benefits. It's those who are non-malevolent, who are malicious, that are the problem. And of course, the overwhelming majority of dictators fall into that category rather than benefiting the people. Mitchell, your further thoughts.
Well, Jim, somewhere along the line, the game, it's going, something is going to happen, and they're going to lose all credibility. And they, you know, it will be a genie they will never be able to put back in the bottle, you know, whether it's government or science or the media. And once they lose that faith, it's like losing freedom to communism. It's damn near impossible to get it back.
Oh, I think you're right. Yes, when rights are curtailed, and that's part of the reason so many of us are so concerned about the absurdities being perpetrated by the Biden administration, especially through their attempted mandates. So I'm very glad to see the courts rejecting them, is that once the government can seize a control over the people, it just does not return, absent a revolution. I mean, you have some great revolutions in history where rights have been restored to the people by a new form of government. But here, the great benefit of our system is we're supposed to be able to bring about changes by means of reforms rather than revolution. And yet by stealing elections, manipulating voting machines, the like, you know, going into nursing homes and manipulating the elderly to vote a certain way, the Democrats, it seemed to me, are doing a lot to destroy what makes America so successful: checks, balances, periodic elections, reforms, referenda, and the like, which I think are indispensable to preserve a democratic form of government and citizen involvement. JFK, of course, observed, those who make peaceful reform impossible make violent revolution inevitable. And there are a good many of those I know who believe we're reaching that point. I doubt, Phil,
Jim,
that
can I just jump in here? There's one thing that in your list there that you missed, which is very prevalent in Europe, which is the protest march. Here in Europe, a lot of questions get settled in the street because people go out and protest against them. And that's another of the really healthy aspects of European politics. Even, for example, with the matter of the COVID mandate and so on, people have been out in the street here, and the government is very hesitant about doing anything like that. And that, it's much harder to do that in the States just because the cities are enormous, they're very spread out, and it's much harder for people to get together. Whereas European cities are densely compacted, And so it's easy for people to go and protest and make their voices heard. I mean, I live, you know, in Madrid, and Madrid is a city that is roughly 15 miles long and 15 miles wide. And in that space, you have a population of about 4.5 million people. So you can see how much easier it is here to protest and to raise hell about things.
That's very interesting, because you see, we notice protests. They're not much covered here in the U.S., of course. They're trying to resist inspiring the American people by example. But most of us, certainly I, have been inclined to think that while they're inspiring, that the governments are non-responsive. You're suggesting actually governments are responding to these mass protests, and we've had them in many different major cities of the world, in Paris, in Berlin, in Melbourne. Australia has been very vigorous, and yet the crackdown in Australia is as brutal as anywhere in the world. So I don't know if that's
governments here. Governments here do watch what happens in the street, for one reason, because protest marches are regularly covered by all of the major news media. That's a very important part of politics here. And again, as I say, it's very healthy.
Well, yes, I think the European press is much less controlled than the American, which is absolutely dominated by Zionist forces. I have a panel of 100 executives from CNN, every one of whom is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. Another panel of executives, 100 executives from NBC, every one of whom is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. Another panel of 100 executives from the New York Times, every one of whom is a dual U.S.-Israeli citizen. And of course, the role of AIPAC in managing our Congress is very well known, and I think devastating to the exercise of real democracy here. I don't know how you view it from your European perspective, Phil, but it seems to me Israel really dominates the American Congress. And of course, Cynthia McKinney revealed the pledge, where new rivals in Washington are asked to sign a pledge to put the interests ahead of Israel, ahead of those of the United States. And those who decline to sign are very few and far between, sad to say.
Here in Spain, for example, the question of Israel and everything is not nearly and the influence of Zionists or Israel or Jews is not nearly what it is. And the result is that Spain has always been much more sympathetic to the Palestinian cause. Now and then on the nightly news here, there's a report from, from Palestine, from Ramallah or from one of these places, and really showing what the Palestinians go through. And I'm sure that at the Israeli embassy, it must make them grind their teeth to see it. But Spain has always had, because, you know, the geographic position, has always had a lot of links to the Arab world. And they are much, people here are much more attuned to what's going on with Israel and Palestine. One interesting point is that just about all the natural gas in Spain comes from Algeria, okay? Some of it by pipe, some of it by ship. And so it's very important for Spain to maintain its good relations in the Arab world.
Yes, I think that's a very interesting point. I wish there were more strong support for Palestinians and the Palestinian cause here in the United States, because it's been, of course, the great human rights issue of perhaps, you know, since the founding of Israel, basically. So we're talking about, 70 years of abuse of Palestinians, and it continues unabated. Just taking over, you know, destroying Palestinian homes, uprooting Palestinian olive groves, the whole bit. I mean, it's massive and it's unreal. And unfortunately, it's come to be taken for granted that this, of course, is going to continue as though it were the way things were supposed to be, sad to say.
Yeah, you know, a really good book to read after you read my book, A Legacy of Chains, just a little crass ad there. A really interesting book to read is John le Carré's novel, The Little Drummer Girl, which is about an Israeli spy espionage operation against the Palestinians. Really presents both sides of the story. Very interesting read. The Little Drummer Girl.
No, I appreciate your mentioning A Legacy of Chains. Indeed, I think many of our viewers might find it quite a fascinating read with your mixture of history and fiction, which I think, you know, enables you to navigate this way of making very telling points while avoiding censorship, which had become so blatant here in the United States. Is there similar censorship throughout the European community to your experience, or is it only here in the U.S. where we so excel at this violation of what most of us regard as a basic right?
Well, just very quickly, I would say that just as there are a wider range of political parties, there's also a wider range of information put out in books and documentaries. That, I think, is better in Europe than in America.
Well, that's very interesting, Phil. Well, I want to thank you for joining today from Spain. It's been a most interesting conversation, and I appreciate Bruce from Texas and Mitchell right here with Revolution Radio joining the conversation. I want to wish everyone the best for the weekend, and if you have a mind, check out my blog, jamesfetzer.org, for False Flags and Conspiracies 2021. The agenda is really impressive. You will learn so much you never suspected could be the case, some of which you'll find to be profoundly disturbing. But if we don't know what we're up against, we can't begin to cope with the reality of the situation we're in. Thank you all for joining us, and spend as much time as you can with your family and those you love, because, frankly, we do not know how much time we have left.
Listening to Revolution Radio.
Como va? This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect Triangle. Live Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The Perfect Triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio Studio A for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle, with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict.